Tonight on the Daily Debrief, tearful testimony from a daughter who found her mother dead.
She was found dead against a wall in a pool of blood.
The state has a timeline the defense says doesn't work.
Just not enough time to have done that.
Is the victim's estranged husband's friend the real killer? Plus, shocking details in the Colorado case of a man accused of killing his fiancée, Kelsey Barrett. Also, a political operative is ordered to court after posting a picture of a federal judge online. The nation's top criminal cases are on the Daily Debrief. It's Tuesday, February 19th. Good evening, everybody. Welcome to the Debrief. A lot to talk about tonight, so let's get straight to it. Opening statements in a Florida murder trial to talk about first, right off the top. David Russell Holbrook Jr. is charged with killing a mother of three back in 2006. Authorities say victim Melissa Howard was stabbed and beaten. She had just won a child custody battle against her ex-husband, Brian Howard. The defendant was Brian's friend. The ex-husband himself is said to have an alibi for the time of the killing. Let's go straight to the prosecution.
You will hear through the course of the trial that there was an ongoing custody battle between Brian Howard and Melissa Howard over primary custody of Taylor. He was about 11 years old at the time. Primary custody was with Brian Howard, and Melissa Howard was seeking to have primary custody with her. You will hear that Melissa was dating a man named Christopher Cadenhead. He worked for UPS. And he would spend a lot of time with Melissa Howard, especially on his breaks. You will also learn that he was married at the time that he was dating Melissa Howard. He will admit that to you. You will hear from him. You will hear from his wife. That is no secret that he was having an affair with Melissa Howard.
A lot of characters in this story. The father has custody. The mother is seeking it, all while she's carrying on a relationship with a married man. The prosecutor moved on now to describe the evening of the victim's death.
Melissa and her son Taylor were at Melissa's house. You will hear that they were playing games, and then Christopher Cadenhead came over like he usually did in the evenings. And soon after he arrived, Melissa took Taylor to meet Brian Howard at the Azteca Mexican restaurant. Chris Cadenhead stayed at Melissa's house during that time, and Melissa then returned to her house to spend some time with Mr. Cadenhead before he had to get back to his UPS duties. There were a lot of people at that dinner. Brian Howard, Taylor Howard, Brian's girlfriend Karina, her son Tyler, his friends, Brian Howard's sister and brother-in-law, a very large gathering at Azteca. At the end of that dinner, Brian Howard, Karina, his girlfriend, Tyler's friends, all went back to Brian Howard's house, where they stayed for the rest of the night.
The prosecutor named the names of many people who were at that dinner. None of them were the defendant. It seems like the prosecutor wanted to immediately clear names of suspicion by saying they were all at that dinner. So next, the case against the defendant.
Also on that Friday night, a birthday party was occurring at David Russell Holbrook's house. That birthday celebration was for his girlfriend's daughter. His brother Michael was there, along with various members of their family and his girlfriend's family. You will hear testimony that Russell and Michael left the party to take Russell's children home to their mother's house, and they dropped the kids off around 9 o'clock. You'll also hear that Russell and his girlfriend Gina spoke by phone at 9:29 p.m. that night. And then you will see Walmart surveillance that shows that the Holbrook brothers went to Walmart at about 9:37 p.m. The question is, what was Russell Holbrook doing between dropping his kids off at their mom's house and talking to his girlfriend at 9:29 and going to Walmart at 9:37?
The night of the crime, the victim's daughter and boyfriend tried to reach her, but her door was locked and they could not get in. The victim always left the door unlocked when her daughter was out, so it was strange. Eventually, the boyfriend and daughter got in.
This is where you will hear of the discovery of Melissa Howard's body. She was found dead against a wall in a pool of blood. You will hear that the living room was in disarray, and you will see photos of what the scene looked like. Couch cushions were all disheveled. Melissa's neck had been slashed, and she was laying against the wall on her right side in a pool of her own blood. You will hear the 911 call that Christopher Caden had made. Again, it is not great quality. You'll be able to understand what's being said, but it is the best we have. While on that call, you'll also hear Christopher Cadenhead having to call his wife, Sherry, and say that he needed her to come to Crestview. That is the night that the news of the affair broke to Sherry Cadenhead, and you'll hear her talk about that. You will hear testimony from the medical examiner, and he will testify to the types of injuries that Melissa Howard sustained, that her cause of death was due to stab wounds, and the manner of death was homicide.
Eventually, prosecutors said DNA from a portion of the victim's shirt matched the Y chromosome of the Holbrook family. That's the defendant's family, and that's the type of DNA transferred from fathers to sons. But before all that, the defendant was attracting the attention of investigators in other ways.
You will also hear testimony that Russell Holbrook had been to Melissa's house 2 days prior, on January 4th of 2006. You'll hear about that from Carrie Winkler, Melissa's daughter. You'll also hear testimony from Taylor Howard that he had seen Russell's truck parked near Brian Howard's house that night when Melissa was dropping him off after church. Now, you'll hear that when the defendant was interviewed by law enforcement, he lied about having been at Melissa's house that Wednesday night. You will hear that he said he had not seen her in years, he had not been to her house in years. You will then hear him admit that he had, in fact, been there on January 4th, 2006. He claims that he lied because he was afraid of having third-party contact with his wife, Allison, who was going through a divorce with Russell. Allison was living with Brian Howard and his girlfriend at the time. Also during that interview, Russell's first story was that he left his house with Michael about 8:30 to take his kids home and then go to Walmart, and that he returned back by 9 o'clock. As I said, you will get to see a Walmart surveillance video showing that he did not even arrive at Walmart until 9:37 that night. You'll hear a later interview of the defendant where his timeline started changing. In the subsequent interview, he said he left his house at 8:40 or 8:45, dropped his kids off right at 9 o'clock, then went to Walmart and was home by 9:15 or 9:30. You'll hear another interview where the timeline keeps shifting.
The defense cut right into those DNA results.
The evidence is going to show the state has some problems, and lots of them. You're going to hear from two DNA experts. One's from FDLE, Florida Department of Law Enforcement, and they're going to say, I anticipate that their witness is going to say that there is some DNA that matches Russell. I believe that's what she's going to say. However, on cross-examination of that witness, let's see how she arrives at those conclusions. Were mistakes made? I think even through the state's opening, they admit that there was a contamination done by this very analyst. I think that that testimony is going to be out there, that a contamination occurred during this investigation of this trial. The contamination occurred on the most important piece of evidence in this trial. You're going to hear B20E, you're going to hear, and you're going to hear lots of it. Now, we are going to present Candy Zuleger. She's our expert. She has years of experience. She's a former FDLE lab analyst, okay? She's worked at FDLE before. And until recently, she owned her own lab. Candy Zuleger is going to explain that the DNA found on, that was tested by the FDLE analyst could be touch DNA. And she's going to explain to you what that is. That when Russell was, as the state has already admitted when Russell was at her house 2 days prior that his DNA, touch DNA, could have been left there. He could have sat on the couch and he could have left some DNA there or any other ways could have been left there.
That's the defense's issue with the DNA, but what about the timeline? The defense says the state's timeline just doesn't add up, doesn't work. It all started at that birthday party.
Left, dropped kids off, went to Walmart, came back home, all wearing the same clothing. No one's frazzled, no one looks any different, no blood, there's nothing on these individuals that would indicate that that Russell had been in any gruesome murder during that time frame, during this timeline. It's going to be very difficult, I believe, and I think the evidence will show it will be very difficult to have done this so-called murder. Just didn't have the opportunity. There's problems. Not enough time. Just not enough time to have done that.
The first witness in this case was the victim's daughter, who tearfully described finding her mother dead.
All right, so you said there was a conversation about trying to jimmy the lock. Was someone successful in doing that?
We were.
All right, so what happened once the door was opened? It's okay, ma'am. Take your time.
Once we were able to open the door, I went into the front foyer and I turned the light on.
What did you see once there was better light?
My mom lying there. She was lying on the wall all the way across.
What did you do once you realized that your mom was there?
I ran back out.
Where were Chris and Daniel while this was going on?
When I ran out, they stepped in.
Where did you go once you ran out of the house?
I ran over next door to our neighbor, Miss Deidre.
You ever go back into the house that night?
Joining me tonight is attorney Matthew Mangino from Pittsburgh. Matthew, let's start out with your analysis of the opening statements as a whole.
Well, I thought that the prosecution laid out in an honest, straightforward fashion the strengths and weaknesses of their case and what they intend to prove. You know, the defense has made some really extraordinary promises. For one, that on cross-examination, they're going to be able to reveal the flaws in the case presented by the prosecution. You know, you make those types of promises, the jurors are going to be sitting there waiting to hear this cross-examination and what it reveals about the weaknesses of the prosecution's case. You really put yourself in a tough spot. You have to prove what you talked about in your opening.
Yeah, hey, but look, this Y chromosome DNA test is messy. The analyst accidentally introduced DNA from a rape kit she was working on into one of the samples. So it seems to me, look, the defense has every right to hammer away at a contaminated sample trying to inculpate a defendant.
Well, there's no question. They're going to go after that that contamination, and they're going to suggest that and somehow linked, Russell Holbrook to this case. You know, but the other thing is they talked about touch DNA. So they're going to suggest that, hey, maybe Russell Holbrook, when he was there, left some DNA. It's not uncommon that DNA can be transferred, not necessarily by some violent act, but merely by having it left on the couch, and then she picks it up from the couch and it's on her shirt. So it's going to be interesting to see how this all evolves and how their expert testifies with regard to this matter.
Exactly. And look, you know, we've also got the issue of the usual suspects being either at this dinner or at this birthday party. And was there enough time in there for them to do anything? Matthew, we'll check in again with you at the end of the broadcast. Another case we are watching here at the Law and Crime Network is expected to begin shortly. David Dooley of Kentucky is facing his second trial on charges he murdered his co-worker Michelle Mockbee. He's getting a second trial because the lead investigator who worked on his case was having an affair with the prosecutor. The first prosecutor also failed to turn a surveillance video over to the defense. A new prosecutor is now in office in that jurisdiction. Jury selection is wrapping up, and opening statements are scheduled tomorrow. Still ahead tonight, here on the Daily Debrief, Colorado authorities are finally saying how they think a suspect murdered Kelsey Barrett. It is gruesome. A preliminary hearing is forcing the answers to light. Plus, could items from the grave have the key to the McStay family murders? We return to this months-long case after the break. Welcome back to The Debrief. New details tonight in the case of the Colorado dad accused of killing his fiancée, and they are coming from a preliminary hearing where cameras were not allowed. Patrick Frazee is facing charges after Kelsey Barrett disappeared last Thanksgiving. Crystal Lee Kenny, said to have been a former girlfriend with a possible rekindled interest in Frazee, admitted helping take Barrett's phone and move it to Idaho. Investigators today testified they tracked Barrett's phone moving to Idaho through the Salt Lake City area. Authorities also testified that Frazee and Kenny came up with a plan to poison Barrett using a Starbucks coffee. Kenny said she didn't go through with it. She also said she didn't go through with two other attempts to kill Barrett. One involved a metal pipe, the other a baseball bat. Kenny claims she didn't go through with either of those plans. When none of those worked, rather, she says Frazee blindfolded Barrett to get her to guess the scent of a candle and then beat her to death. Kenny says she's the one who ultimately cleaned up. State crime scene investigators say they found evidence of blood in Barrett's bathroom. Also, a cadaver dog picked up a faint scent near Barrett's car. Plus, Frazee's own mother refused to testify at first today, invoking her Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. The prosecutor said Frazee's mother saw a black tote bag being burned. Authorities have linked that black tote back to Frazee and questioned if the body was in it. Frazee's interviews with police suggested he and Barrett had broken up and were in the process of figuring out the custody of their daughter. Now to national legal news. Supreme Court Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg is back on the bench for the first time since surgery. Ginsburg tripped, fell, and fractured three ribs in December. During treatment, nodules of cancer were discovered on her lung, so she underwent treatment for the cancer and today resumed hearing arguments. Ginsburg has twice suffered broken ribs during her career. She also has had lung cancer, colon cancer, pancreatic cancer, and has a stent in her heart. She's 85 and says she plans to work until she's at least 90. Political operative Roger Stone has apologized for posting a picture of a federal judge with crosshairs nearby on his Instagram account. Judge Amy Berman Jackson is the judge pictured. She's also the one overseeing Stone's case. Stone took the image down after an hour and said it was something he reposted from the web. He issued a formal apology to the judge and also apologized online. Stone is accused of obstructing proceedings, making false statements, and witness tampering. A coalition of 16 states today filed a federal lawsuit against President Donald Trump for attempting to construct a wall on the border with Mexico by declaring a national emergency. The lawsuit argues that Trump's moves violate the separation of powers doctrine of the United States Constitution. It further argues that Trump went beyond what powers are given to him and that his move violates environmental laws. Testimony resumed today in a California murder trial expected to last months. Charles Merritt is accused of murdering his business partner, Joseph McStay, and McStay's entire family. The prosecution says the motive was money. The family disappeared back in 2010. A dirt biker found the bodies of all four McStays buried in the desert a couple of years later. In court today, questions concerning more of the evidence found buried with the family's bodies. Prosecutors showed jurors images of murder victim Summer McStay's undergarments. Authorities made no attempt to test them for evidence of a sexual assault because of environmental conditions in the desert and the passage of time. They did talk about attempting to test for DNA, though, on some of the items. Testimony will continue into the evening in this case. Earlier in the case, we heard some similar testimony about those same items.
When looking at the photograph on the left side of the bra, there appeared to be, I called it a white substance. To me, it was consistent with paint, but I don't know for sure. Excuse me, exactly what it was.
It had a distinct pattern to it, correct?
Yes, sort of a drip. It was dripping.
Can you orient what you're seeing to us on how it would be if worn? Is that possible?
If this bra, this would be the left cut, so it would be the dripping, the drip, the flow stains right here, where it could the substance appeared to have flown or flowed towards the center. If it was being worn at the time, it would have been towards the center of the bra.
Let's turn once again to attorney Matthew Mangino on this case. So, Matthew, look, we've heard disjunctive testimony. Talk about a bumpy ride here, because we've got testimony about the undergarments, okay, and then we had testimony about basically the same garments a couple of weeks ago in this case. Back then it was about the paint, and the assumption is that the family was painting and then that the paint flowed in such a way that maybe if she was wearing them, then maybe she was laying on the floor when something was repainted. And now we've got this other evidence saying they weren't checked for sexual assault DNA.
Well, Aaron, this is a difficult case. Again, we're talking about, 9 years ago the family disappeared. The prosecution, has a difficult task here, and that is to piece together this evidence from 9 years ago that was discovered later, obviously, that had been out in the desert. So it's a tough case. It's tough sledding, and it's tedious, I'm sure, for the jury. This evidence being presented at different times, repeatedly for different reasons, can really be difficult for the jury to keep context here.
I can understand that, Matthew Mangino. I appreciate your analysis rather on the debrief as always.
Thank you, Aaron.
We'll see you next time. And thanks for those of you who are watching the debrief at home tonight. I'll see you right back here tomorrow at 5 o'clock on the Law and Crime Network. Live trial coverage begins at 9 o'clock. It's going to be a jam-packed day, so we hope to see you then. Have a good night.